Quinn Buckner joins us on Sports Byline, former NBA player and coach after an outstanding college career at Indiana, and he won both an NCAA championship and an NBA title. And he won an Olympic gold medal with the U.S. team at the 76 games in Montreal, and he's been inducted into the College Basketball Hall of Fame. He was selected by the Bucks with the seventh pick of the 76 NBA draft, and he had a 10-year NBA career with Milwaukee, the Celtics, and Indiana, and he also won an NBA title with the Celtics in 84. And, of course, you see him and hear him doing broadcasts on almost all the major networks. Quinn, when you think and hear what I had to say about your career, what is the thing that jumps out to you the most?
Well, for me, it's an out-of-body experience, if you want to know the truth. I'm dead serious. It's one of those things that, as a kid, there's some of the things you'd really like to do and some you never even thought of. My aspiration, honestly, was to be a really good teammate initially. That's really all I wanted to be, and to try to make a contribution there, and then to try to be more of an Olympian. I won't say never, but it wasn't a high priority to try to be an NBA player. But I'm very proud to have been on teams where everybody understood their role, and we were able to have success with it. I mean, listen, it's great fun. There's no question about it. But it's very humbling, and as I said, and I tend to keep it as an out-of-body experience so I can. Because otherwise, it's easy with that kind of stuff happening to not be humble. And I don't want to let myself ever get that way.
Let's go back to the beginning. You played high school basketball in Dalton, Illinois. That's a little bit outside of Chicago, is it not?
It's a southeast suburb of Chicago, Illinois. I grew up in a town called Phoenix, Illinois. And I went to Thorn Ridge, Dalton. And it was a good school. It was a big school. It's probably 4,000 students, so you were able to find some pretty good players. But all the really good players, basically with the exception of one, came from my little neighborhood, Phoenix, Illinois. But, yeah, I went to Thorn Ridge Dalton.
Yeah, I know they had some pretty good teams there, and you were on those pretty good teams, won back-to-back state championships, and that 1972 team was undefeated, and it's often been called the greatest high school basketball team in the history. What made it so good?
We had five guys that really all were Division I players. I mean, I think you got to have that. My coach, Ron Ferguson, was a very, very good coach. Allowed us to kind of put a perspective on it. We were bust my freshman year to school, which actually was the second year. So we had to go in and deal with a lot of that. But our coach trusted us enough, the kids from my neighborhood, to allow us to just go play, because most of us were really good kids. We, you know, if you make mischievous mistakes, you make that. But he trusted us. We trusted each other. And if you've got five D1 players on a team that are willing to be defined by their roles and commit to it, you got a chance to have some success. And we did. All of us were distinct in our skill set. And no one got really, with the exception of one guy, may get a little caught up. He didn't get enough publicity. The rest of us didn't really care. We were just trying to win.
You were a very talented athlete, not only in basketball, you also excelled as a football player, and you were the only person ever named Chicago Area Player of the Year for both football and basketball. Tell me about the football side of you.
I'm very grateful to the man above, to God. My gift was actually athlete, football, and then basketball. I could play football, honestly, without thinking about it. I mean, the instincts in football were just there, and I don't know how to tell you that. I played Pop Warner football and just had a feel for it there. But then I started playing more so in high school, and I played very well. I played primarily as a safety, but I did play every position but quarterback on the offensive side. And again, I'm telling you, my dad was a football player, and I think that's where a lot of the knowledge came, but the instinct probably came sitting watching games with him. He played at Indiana University on their undefeated team, so he used to talk to me about football. But I am telling you that I played it because I enjoyed it, and this is to kind of tell you about the gift. I honestly didn't do the gift justice. I used to practice football on the college level and didn't tie my shoes. It is as arrogant as it is funny. And I didn't realize the arrogance of it. I just knew that I could do it. But that tells you the kind of gift that I had. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. But at some point, you have to make a decision about what you want to do. Because just for me, from a concentration standpoint, I just decided football was not what I wanted to do.
I want to take you back to the neighborhood for just a second, because I think one of the great mental images about basketball, whether it be inner city or just in a small town, is a hot summer day, high humidity, sun going down, five shirts, five skins playing on the blacktop. There's something special about that, isn't it, Quinn?
You heard me react to it right away. Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, even if you're playing that, I mean, the sun could be going down, but it could be, you know, right around noon if you can get five guys to do that for whatever reason. Yeah, that's when it's at its purest. That's when everybody's just trying to play, trying to do what they do, have fun. You know, you don't have the pressures of you know, league if you're in the NBA, of having to feel like you got to do this to win a championship. And then the real key as you move up the pendulum is to make sure you keep it as pure as possible. And if you're able to do that, you can have fun and accomplish a mission. But the purest you can have it is shirts and skin on the court, right there on the court. And at that point, it's as competitive as it's going to be, and everybody's as honest and raw about their emotions, and you just play.
Tell me about the recruitment process of Quinn Bucker to play basketball in college.
I was really blessed. Again, I could have played it, you know, given what had happened, that, as you said, in the state of Illinois, having won both high school player of the year on both sides, I could have gone anywhere. And I looked at five schools, and I made that choice. My father and I had a discussion one day, and he asked me what I wanted to do. I said, God rest his soul, I said, Daddy, I don't really feel like going all over the place to look at a lot of schools. He said, well, then why don't you pick out a few and make your decision? So I looked at Kansas. I looked at Michigan, UCLA, Indiana, Illinois, because I'm an Illinois kid. And I looked at Cincinnati because a friend of mine had gone to Cincinnati. And frankly, he had helped me play basketball. A guy named Lloyd Batts, who played at Cincinnati and was an All-American there. But he grew up in the same town I did. So that was why I went to visit Cincinnati for Lloyd. I had no intentions of going. But the truth is, my dad had been recruiting me to Indiana for years, and I didn't know it because I have a sister who's 4 years older than myself. And we would go to see her periodically, I'd say maybe a couple times a year, and she went to school at Indiana. I'm going to see her, and my dad, having played at Indiana, had this friend, dear man named Howard Brown, who was on the team with my father. And I would see Coach Brown, and I see my sister, and I'd see various places. But I wasn't thinking about it in the context of what my interests were. I was thinking that they had just taken me around. So my dad was recruiting me to Indiana when I was going to see my sister. I just didn't know it. So that's how I got to Indiana.
We got about 2.5 minutes before we have to break here. You know, you talk about your dad, and I can just get the sense and feel that he had such an instrumental part in your life, developing your personality, your character, your drive, and everything. Tell me a little bit about that. What did he give you? What did he tell you?
My dad was always about it. First of all, I'm the proud son of William and Jessica Buckner, and please know that my mother was as impactful as my dad. My dad was much more impactful on my athletic career. My mother was much more impactful on my academic career. My parents are teachers. I'm the only non-teacher in a house of six. My dad really imparted on me the importance of, one, making sure that you do your work. You work hard at your craft. You work hard at whatever you do. But he was also, this is the thing that got me over, if you will, the proverbial hump. He said, son, you got to think. You need to be smarter than they are, because you got to understand most guys are going to be more talented than you, especially if you want to play basketball. And he made a real point of understanding what was going on every possession, how guys did things, how you can make them do the things you wanted to do so you could have success. He was very, very strong and adamant about the mental aspect of the game more so than the physical. That's why Coach Knight made more sense to my parents to me than they did. Than Coach Knight made sense to me was because they knew that the preparation was as much mental, or more so mental, than it was physical. And that's what my dad imparted on me, was about being smarter than guys on the floor.
In about a minute before we break here, Quinn, I'm going to make an observation, and if I'm wrong about this, please feel free to correct me. I always had the sense, and I watched you both professionally and when you were in college, that one of the other things that he passed on to you was staying even-keeled, not getting too high, not getting too low, because then you'd get out of control if you were too high or too low. Am I correct in that observation?
That would be a correct observation. In this generation, they may not remember it. There was a commercial that said, never let them see you sweat. And that was my dad's motto. He said, don't ever let them see that you sweat, that you're mad about something that's happened. Make sure that you stay, pretty much that's what he said, stay even keel. And, you know, don't get mad, get smart. was what he always used to say. And so that forces you to become more mental or methodical from an intellectual standpoint about a guy who's beaten you on a play. How can I set him up so he doesn't beat me again? What can I do intellectually? So it was, don't get mad, get smart. Yeah, that was pretty much the motto of the house.
We're talking basketball with Quinn Buckner, former NBA player and coach after an outstanding career at Indiana, and he won both an NCAA championship and an NBA title as well. He won an Olympic gold medal with the U.S. team at the 76 games in Montreal, and he has been inducted into the College Basketball Hall of Fame. When we come back, we're going to talk to him about the first time he ever met Bobby Knight. We do that as we continue across the country and around the world with you on Sports Byline. Quinn Buckner has joined us here on Sports Byline USA. We're talking about his life and about his career. After having an outstanding high school basketball career, he decided to go to the University of Indiana, or Indiana University. Tell me a little bit about the first time you met Coach Bob Knight.
Well, meeting Coach Knight was interesting. He come to recruit at my house, and Scott May, who played with me in college, and Mike Woodson, who was a great player at Indiana. Myself just went to see Coach Knight, and Coach Knight was telling the story, and I really had forgotten about it. We have a small house, you know, we're just lower middle class, you know, teacher kind of education. I say all of that to say my dad used to take what is considered an ottoman, we call it a footstool, and he would turn it upside down, and my dad was 280 and 5'10", so he's very overweight, and he'd have his elbows on it. And Coach Knight come in, and he was talking to him. And Coach Knight talked about the fact that he came in, and both my dad and I are dark complected. So we didn't have any lights on in the front room. And my dad is watching TV, and Coach comes in and is talking. And he couldn't tell whether my dad was looking at Coach Knight or looking at TV. But the net of it was, when I met him, there's a lot of reasons to be impressed by Coach Knight, because you listen to him, his when he talked to you, he talked with you. He didn't talk at you. He came at you from a pure intellectual standpoint, and with a great sense of honesty, integrity, and that's what I remember about it. And so I was, you know, I wasn't thrown by it, because my dad, God rest his soul, is pretty much the same way. He comes at you, and you come at right at you. There was no trying to sugarcoat it. You know, I'm gonna get my TV voice or anything like that. So I was accustomed to that. So when I met Coach Knight, I had a sense of what that personality was like. What I didn't expect from Coach Knight, and my mother recently passed, but what I do remember and this was how Coach Knight had my mother wrapped around his finger, and it was, there's no doubt about it. And my mother was impactful on my decision to go to Indiana, though my dad was the main one. But my mother knew that Indiana and Coach Knight was what I needed, because Coach Knight had that ability to get to the mom, knowing that she was the one that was going to drive the decision in some form or fashion.
Yeah, it's been said that you had a better relationship than any other player in Hoosiers history, and you said one time, the one thing that I learned early was to respect authority figures, right or wrong, and I think that helped you a great deal in your relationship with him.
Well, that's my dad. My dad had made the point. I mean, as I was growing up, he was very adamant about that. I mean, whomever's in charge, that's who you're listening to, and you do what they tell you to do. And my dad wasn't the one to tell you. He didn't tell you the same thing twice. So it made it, again, easy to follow Coach Knight in the sense that he was in charge. If he said do it, that's what you do. And liking it had nothing to do with what you were trying to get accomplished. You do what whomever, man or woman, who's ever in charge, tells you to do. And I think it makes it easier for you, because you get your mind prepared to make whatever adjustment or assessment you have to make. And then from there, you execute the plan to try to make whatever they've asked to happen. And then that way you stay out of getting into the bad side of people with really tough personalities that have to tackle you, and not verbally tackle you, not really tackle you, but to come after you. So I that's the other thing. I didn't necessarily care to be yelled at. And my parents knew that as well. And Coach Knight knew it as well. And what I had to fight was my reaction, which is to get really stubborn to try to get something done. And again, that's that staying even thing that I had to work my way through probably my first 2 years, but it worked out great.
How hard was it for everybody else, your other teammates, to get on the page and to get comfortable with that enough to have the great success that you did during those 4 years, not just you, but that whole Indiana team?
Well, the guys I played with are really smart. And Scott Mayer is done well since he left. I mean, he was really smart. Wilkerson really understood what he had to do. Jim Crews, who played for us, did some really, really good things. Abernathy was smart. We had some smart players. And that makes all the difference in the world. I mean, people have on many occasions talked about the fact that Coach talks about me being the captain of the team. It's easy to captain a team, quote unquote. If you got guys that are smart, all you got to do is make sure you remind each other what it is you need to do. And periodically, you make mistakes, you support each other, and you keep going. But no one ever took it personal, which I thought was really important in our team because of where I was raised and how I was raised, I would have a tendency to bark at you. And if you knew that what I was doing was trying to do what we needed to get done based on what I was told to get done, it was never personal. It's like, we're trying to win a game. Now, you either want to try to win the game or you need to go sit down. This is not a debate. And so with our guys, I didn't have to do that very often because they were all smart. They'd come and tell you, hey, I got to get there. I'll get there next time. And there's things of those nature. So it makes it a lot easier when you're playing with people that smart.
In your freshman season, Indiana reached the Final Four, but you lost to UCLA. And then in the two consecutive seasons, 74-75 and 75-76, the Hoosiers were undefeated in the regular season. And then the magical season was certainly 75-76 because you served as the co-captain and the Hoosiers went the entire season and the 1976 tournament without a single loss, and you finally beat Michigan 86-68 in the title game. But let me go back the year before, because Scott May broke his arm and was only available to you guys for about 7 minutes when you played in the regionals against Kentucky. But did that season really set up the undefeated season for you all the next year when you won the championship?
I thought so. I didn't think there was much question about it. We were the best team in basketball in 75, which in my opinion was the better of the two teams until Scott got hurt. But I also think that as we were working our way, because we had a few games before we got to the regionals that Scott didn't play. And, you know, we won those games and had some, you know, we won those. And I do believe that there is a part of us as a team that thought we were prepared to win a championship, though we hadn't done the work. And so when we played Kentucky, who we had soundly beaten early in the year, we played them in Dayton, Ohio. They were better prepared emotionally to play than we were, and there's no two ways about it. But I think having lost that game, we learned a lesson about the preparation you need every game, and if you want to have a chance to win a championship. And so that from that game on, and I remember this distinctly. It was the first time in the 3 years I was at Indiana University, IU, that I could go home for spring break, and I did not like it because I prefer to be playing during spring break. And I was also going into my last year, so it was important that I was prepared, and the seniors prepared that way. But it was because we didn't have the success in 75 that we were so much better prepared, I think, to win it in 76. And in fact, I'm not sure we win in 76 if we win in 75, because there's just a couple people that would have a hard time dealing with that success. So not having the success in 75 catapulted us, I think, to having a successful 76.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. You also were on the United States Olympic basketball team, the 76 Olympics. And, you know, you can talk about winning the gold medal, but I think what happened in 72 with the U.S. national team probably was something that kicked you guys in the rear end to kind of right a wrong. Am I correct in that observation?
Well, it really was. I had been watching the Olympics, believe it or not. Well, this is when they were very prominent. So I'd watched them since I was in like third or fourth grade. So by the time I was in college, I had seen what had happened. Effectively, this happened the summer before I started college with the Olympic team and how they, you know, in my opinion, got the championship taken away from them. And because of that, it became a higher priority to be a part of what we could recapture from that, because it felt very strongly basketball in America was the best basketball. And it's, that's how our group felt. So having the opportunity to, I don't want to avenge that, if you will, what we felt was a wrong was really important. And we had a lot of guys who people didn't think, you know, we had, you know, four guys from Carolina. We had maybe six guys from the ACC at the time. And you know, Scott and myself were blessed enough to be there. And I don't think that people felt like the team was going to had a good chance to win. So there were all kind of additional motivations that we wanted. But most importantly, we wanted to try to get that gold medal back that we felt was unfairly you know, you can call it whatever, hand it, given, take it away from the U.S. anyway. And so winning a gold medal for the U.S. in 76 was really an important, I think, milestone for all of us.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You were robbed. The Americans were robbed of that. Adrian Dantley, Mitch Kupchak, and Scott May, all of that on that gold medal winning team. We only have a minute left before we have to break here. Were you prepared to go for the go into the NBA? How prepared were you?
I had played against pros since I was a junior in high school, so I was very comfortable playing against them. And I think that in playing in the pros, you've got to have confidence. And I had success playing against them because I grew up outside of Chicago, so I used to play with some of the Bulls. And the guy I mentioned to you, Lloyd Batts, who had gone to Cincinnati, played with them all the time, and he used to take me to play with them. So by the time I was ready to go when I left school, I wasn't, you know, there's, I think some guys go through a fear factor. I wasn't afraid to play against them because I knew I could play against them. So to answer your question, I felt good about the opportunity. I knew I could play against them. I didn't know if I was going to make, make a team or whatever. But, I got lucky enough to be the first pick for the Milwaukee Bucks and the seventh pick in the draft. That says that you probably got an opportunity to do some pretty good things. And from there, I just tried to keep working and see what I could do and stay on the team.
And he did it very well, particularly on the defensive side, which I want to talk to him about as we continue here. Quinn Buckner with us, former NBA player and coach, also an outstanding college player, won a gold medal for the United States in the Olympic Games in 1976. And when we come back, we'll talk about that NBA pro career that Quinn Buckner had as we continue with more of you on America's Sports Talk Show. Quinn Buckner has joined us here on Sports Byline USA. You heard Quinn say that he was picked in the first round, seventh overall, by the Milwaukee Bucks. And I suppose there's a couple of ways to look at being drafted. And I suppose also that back in 76, it wasn't such a big deal whether you went to the New York Knicks, Chicago Bulls, or Los Angeles, big market teams. But you go to Milwaukee. How did you approach being drafted by Milwaukee and playing in that city?
Well, the world is kind of interesting. Coach Knight still does have a very dear friend named Wayne Embry, who had played at the University of Cincinnati, but he also had played for the Boston Celtics and Red Auerbach. And so Coach Knight had a relationship with Wayne Embry, who was the as a matter of fact, he's the general manager for the Bucks, and is the man that drafted me. He had seen me practice, and Coach Knight didn't let a lot of people come in practice. I wasn't assured that I was going to Milwaukee, quite frankly, but because I was familiar with Wayne through Coach Knight, I was, again, you got that whole confidence thing. You got people that you know, and it was only about 100 miles from where I grew up, so I was very comfortable in that environment. Now, mind you, I go there, and I think it's 2 years after they trade Kareem Abdul-Jabbar from Milwaukee to Los Angeles. So the guys I'm playing with, one of the guys was from the Northwest Indiana, Junior Bridgman, who had a great career and has done very well since, and Brian Winters. So we got to be close, and then we got Alex English. And so we were a good young team that was trying to grow, but it was hard for all of us at first because I had played on the IU teams, and, we'd done well. We'd only lost one game between my junior and senior year, and then by the time I get to the pros, we lose 52 games in my first year, and I had to really have a real talk with myself about, how to stay involved in the game, stay engaged with the process in order to have success. So it was tough the first year, but it was something that turned out to be pretty good for all of us.
Another observation on my part, I have found over my years in being in broadcasting, whether it's Frank Robinson, it's Bill Russell, or even if it's somebody like Don Nelson or Bob Knight, that the great coaches, the great people in their respective sports, have a real tough time coaching others who may not have the same commitment to the sports and to excellence. Is that the case? And two, was Don Nelson in that category after having won so many championships as a player and coaching as well with the Boston Celtics?
Nelly is unique in that he's bright, but he also very creative. And he wanted to see some different things. He saw the game differently than I did. And because he coached me, I was on Don Nelson's first team. And by the time I was done there, I wasn't the kind of player that could play for him. But it wasn't because he didn't like me. He wanted players that could score more because Nelly saw this whole influx of the way the game is played today. He was doing that back in the early 80s. So he was able to recognize and he looked for people to play that way. But I think, candidly, I think anybody that's going to have success in any kind of role has to have some intellectual capacity, and all the people you name have great capacity. I happen to think Bill Russell is one of the smartest, if not the smartest man I ever knew, and Coach Knight is right there. But my mother was extremely bright, so I've been around intelligence for a good portion of my life. But I'm telling you, those guys, you look at La Russa, you go up and down the line for the people that had success, they're very smart. And some of it to the point that it's that it's pragmatically bright. It may not be that, you know, space kind of smart, but they're pragmatically bright, and they're very efficient in their thought process and what they try to get done.
I mentioned a little bit earlier that you were defensive-minded, and you were very successful at it in the NBA. Four times you were named to the NBA's All-Defensive Second Team, and the late Dennis Johnson once told me that defense was more attitude than it was anything else. Was he right about that?
Yeah, I played with DJ in Boston, and it really was about an attitude. I mean, that's what I brought to it. The one thing I knew about, and this was part of the playing football, I knew you couldn't hurt me. You're not going to hurt me in basketball. Because I played football, and I played against, you know, at that time, two of the best college teams in sports. When you play against Ohio State and Michigan, you're playing against them, you're playing against pros. So any basketball play that needs to be made, I can make it, and I got a better chance of coming out of it unscathed than you do. And so I had that mindset, particularly defensively, and in that mindset, it was not any different than I felt overall on both sides of the ball. If you're a better player than me, you better be better than me on every part of every possession, or I've got the same opportunity to be better than you. And that was a mindset I had to have both offensively, but more importantly, defensively, when I played against great scorers. So DJ, God rest his soul, is absolutely right. A tremendous defensive player in his own right.
I was impressed with two quotes that I found from you. You once said, "My strength is defense. Another is my overall knowledge of the game and being able to get everybody involved in the game." And the one thing that I've always said about Michael Jordan is that he understood the game so well that he knew from a moment-to-moment basis what he needed to do to make his team better and for the team to be able to win. And I got that same impression of you. You like that mental aspect of understanding the game.
Oh, there's no doubt. It was a big part of what, you know, that the gift that was presented to me. I wanted to bring that to it. But equally as important as that is being able to engage everybody in it. Because if you don't throw it to big people, if they're in the post, they're not going to, so they got a chance to shoot the ball, they're not going to rebound. I mean, it's just that simple. And it's those kind of things. And these are more humanistic kind of things from the human element of how to get people to do what it is they need to do. And do it and enjoy being a part of the greater good. That was what I was always about, because I was never particularly in college, I was never a great scorer in college, but I figured out when Benson needed the ball, if Scott goes a couple plays and doesn't need it, I've got to get him a shot. You know, if Abernathy's wide open, he gets it. So understanding those kind of intricacies, if you will, in the game and the impact in the overall game, that was very important to me and Coach Knight and how I view the game. I just think you have to be able to engage everybody in it, because if you don't, when you need them, they're not going to be there because they're not engaged.
What was your reaction to what they said about your offensive game and your shot? Because I have a quote here. It says, "Your low trajectory shot was jokingly said to have been responsible for more bent rims than Daryl Dawkins' dunks."
Never bothered me. It didn't bother, and that could be the negative in it, that I didn't work harder at it, but I was still able to make the contribution to the game. I was always, I would say, more than not. If there's a shot that needed to be made, I found a way to make it. If I got to the foul line, not being a good foul shooter, I could make shots. Now, I accepted the fact that I didn't shoot it well, but it didn't mean that I couldn't play, and that's really the arrogance in which I played with, and that arrogance being just an overabundance of confidence. I didn't shoot it well, but I can still play and beat you. And so it didn't bother me if somebody said it. The facts are, if you're shooting in the low 40s at that time from the field, you don't shoot it well. You can't shoot. And if you're not shooting 70, 75% from the foul line, you can't shoot. Both of those were true of me, but I never let those be the detriment of myself. I thought it was more important to figure out another way to make a contribution, so I didn't let it bother me.
Yeah, I like that self-confidence about you. You understood yourself and your talents, because you said, "I've never had an illusion that shooting is one of my strengths. In fact, it was a very known weakness that I had. You play with a lot of pride and work hard every night out," and that was the key to your career, I think.
No, it really was. I think it's one of the things. Well, Coach Knight has said this. I didn't pay it attention for many years, and just because I'm a little weird this way. What he liked about me coming to Indiana and is that I allowed him to coach me. You talked about the success I had in Illinois. I'm averaging 25 points and, you know, 6-7 rebounds coming from the best team that had won the championship. I didn't know, neither did they know, it was going to be one of the best teams in the history of the state of Illinois. But I came in, and I didn't worry about scoring that much. Now, he did have to get on me sometimes because my instinct from playing that way so long in college, in high school, would seep in. But the fact that I was willing to let him coach me to do what I did best versus the aspects that I'd really need a great deal of work on or didn't do well, which was shooting all the time, which I did more so in high school, the fact that I was willing to try to pass the ball, to guard and get other people involved in the game, I think that's where, and this is just looking back over the years, that's where I think he's had some real admiration for what I was willing to do. Because a lot of people aren't willing to let you take away 25 points a game just because you come to college. They still think that they have to do that. And for a while, I did think I had to score, but not at that rate. And I eventually just let all of that go because the greater good did not need me to be that kind of player. And I accepted that.
Yeah, one of the great moments in your pro career came just before the 82-83 season when you were traded to the Boston Celtics for center Dave Cowens. And you had to really have a positive reaction about that because you once said, "I've always admired the Boston style of play, and I feel I can play it." And Red Auerbach said, "He's a winner, a leader. He rises to the occasion. He has a good personality. He's team-oriented, and he's disciplined." That sounds like a marriage made in heaven.
Well, it really was, and it was and Coach Knight recognized that it was an opportunity to be one of the few people to have success on every level and that kind of thing, and he had to help me through it because I struggled with the fact that I was starting to have success in Milwaukee and was a ballot all-star and got traded, and not only get traded. Now, this is how your ego can get into you. I got traded for a guy in Dave Cowens who was a terrific player when he played but had been driving a cab for a couple of years. So that challenged my whole intellect. But once I got to Boston, it was really terrific. Now, what I really, felt about myself from the time I started playing basketball, more so in college than high school, I always felt like I wanted to be a Celtic or I was a Celtic. Reason being, they played the game the right way. The right guy got the ball, open guy got it, got a shot, you take it, everybody help, all of those kind of things. And so that was, in retrospect, one of the great, great things that's ever happened to me. I also happened to spend through Larry Bird, who I gravitated to when I got there initially, and just because we're both had ties to the state of Indiana, to Red Auerbach, who's one of the great minds, and I don't care if you talk sports, business, or whatever, that ever lived, and got to spend time with him. Now, the unique thing about, that whole relationship with Coach Knight and Red Auerbach. Red Auerbach always called Coach Knight when he wanted to know about good players in college basketball and didn't call anybody else from what Coach Knight has said. It says something about Coach Knight, but it also just brings the whole Celtic spirit, the way that they play, the way Coach Knight tried to get us to play at Indiana. I've been one of the most blessed athletes, I think, for me in the history of sports. But that, I'm not biased there. It's just I don't know how else to explain it.
We only have a little bit over 2 minutes left. You win your championship ring with Boston in 1984, and it was a 7-game series against the Lakers. Tell me what was the turning point in that series for Boston.
Well, the turning point was when we had one of our guys who was as non-confrontational as we had on the team, and Kevin McHale was going down the court. He clotheslined James Worthy. He's close on. I think it's Worthy or at this point, I don't remember, either Worthy or Rambis. And I think it might have been Rambis. So he clotheslined it, but he's trying to catch him. And Rambis is going so fast that he just takes him off his feet. And taking him off the feet was interesting because when you had the Lakers and the Celtics, what you had was blue collar, the Northeast, that slow kind of pace, the way the East played. And then you had Showtime with the Lakers. And the Lakers had been pretty much getting out in Showtime. That play changed it all because now the Lakers could not run and feel like they would do it without some impunity. So it really slowed their pace down within their pace. And from there, I think the Celtics, we all realized, listen, we got to play faster. they're going to play fast. They may not play as fast as they did before. We got to play faster. But it became a more physical series. And once that happened, that was much more what we wanted as opposed to the Showtime up and down. But that play, that was the play, is really symbolic of the 80s, but it was symbolic of the Celtics winning the championship for sure in 84 and probably in 86 in some ways.
In 45 seconds, when you think back on your long basketball career, is there a moment ingrained in Quinn Buckner's mind that he'll never forget?
Yeah, when they put the gold medal on my neck and they played the Star Spangled Banner, the national anthem, if you will, when you win the gold medal for the Olympics. There's no better moment. I enjoyed winning the championship, the first one in high school, second one in high school. I enjoyed college. And I enjoy the NBA. But when you represent your country and you're the best in the world, there's nothing like it. Nothing, especially when they're playing the Star-Spangled Banner, USA. You can't beat it.
Quinn, I want to thank you very much. This has been so inspirational and insightful as well. And what I respect about you is not only the game you played, basketball, how you played it on the court, but what you were like off the court, because you set a standard for excellence as well. And as you said, you've been very, very blessed, but you're deserving of being blessed that way. Thank you, my friend. Come back and visit with me again.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Quinn Buckner, former NBA player and coach, after an outstanding college career at Indiana. He won both an NCAA championship and an NBA championship, and he also won the gold medal for the United States team in the 1976 games in Montreal in the College Basketball Hall of Fame. We've got you on Sports Byline.